On your outline that you have, I'm going to go back to the first page. We talked last time about the fact that God created marriage at the beginning of the human race, before there was any government, any schools, any hospitals, any churches, any society at all. There was the family. There was marriage between a man and a woman, namely Adam and Eve. Number two, God's definition of marriage wasn't just for the Jewish people at the time of Exodus and the Sinai covenant. It was for the beginning of the creation of the human race, and so it was for all people for all time. Number three, marriage between a man and a woman is the most fundamental institution in any society, and every human nation on earth throughout history has recognized some form of marriage that needs to be defined and recognized and supported and protected. And then number four, some types of relationship are not permitted. And we talked last week about the Bible's prohibition against incest, against adultery, and against homosexual conduct. And I looked at a number of those verses in some detail on homosexual conduct. Number five, we talked about the question of polygamy in the Old Testament. God allowed it. God allowed polygamy, but he never commanded polygamy. He allowed it temporarily. And the expressions in the New Testament and the narrative examples show that whenever a man has more than one wife, what happens? There's trouble. And so those of you who have been married for a while, both husbands and wives, you can understand that. And in the New Testament, for church officers anyway, the standard was established, husband of one wife. Divorce was allowed in some cases, and that's a separate topic, but divorce and remarriage was allowed for certain cases where a marriage was destroyed. Number seven, and this is where we ended last week, civil government should define and regulate marriage for all citizens. Now, some people say today, oh, just let churches marry people that they want to marry and let other people do what they want. That'll bring total chaos to the structure of society. And as far as government is concerned, defining marriage and regulating marriage gives fulfillment to the purposes that God has for government. It restrains evil, number one. It promotes sexual faithfulness and care for children and other things. Number two, it brings good to society. It promotes social stability and economic well-being and other benefits we'll talk about in a minute. And it brings order to society so the public knows who is married and who is not and who is responsible for care and protection and training of children and for care of spouses in need. So civil government should define and regulate marriage for all citizens. It brings great benefits to the society. Now, I've got section B here, arguments from reason and experience apart from the Bible. Here I'm in Scottsdale Bible Church. I was teaching on the fact that the Bible teaches about the creation of Adam and Eve, and it teaches about moral standards for marriage and prohibits adultery and prohibits incest and prohibits homosexual conduct. But what if you're talking to someone who doesn't believe the Bible or doesn't take the Bible as authoritative? Are there some reasons that we can use to support the idea of marriage between one man and one woman apart from the Bible? Well, number one, I think there is this. Governments should define an established marriage because no other institution can do that for an entire society. That is, the church can't define marriage for an entire society because a lot of people don't belong to any one church or any church at all. I mean, you can't just say Scottsdale Bible Church can define marriage for Scottsdale because, I don't know, 98% of the population or 95% of the population of Scottsdale doesn't go to Scottsdale Bible Church. You can't say that all Protestant churches or all Protestant Catholic churches can define marriage because they might not even agree, but even if they did, lots of people don't go to those churches. And so it would be, even if you added in Jewish synagogues and other kinds of religions, you don't have the solution of how you define marriage for a whole society. The media, you want to have the media define marriage for a whole society? No, okay, we don't even have to discuss that. How about schools, colleges and universities? How about ASU defining marriage for the whole society. Well, nice an institution as ASU is, I don't think there would be a consensus, and it wouldn't get everybody to agree. So the only way you can get a single definition of what marriage is for a society is if government defines it. Does that make sense? Should government encourage a certain kind of marriage? Yes, I think so. Point two, government should encourage and reward marriage between one man and one woman because marriage gives benefits to society that no other relationship or institution can give. That's the basic argument, that marriage between one man and one woman gives benefits that no other arrangement or relationship can give. And so because of those benefits, it's right, it's healthy, it's positive for society as a whole through government to say, well, we're going to encourage this relationship. We're going to give certain legal and financial benefits and protections to this relationship. Why? Well, I'm going to list these benefits, but I want to say that this is not the first time that the United States has faced this controversy. The controversy was faced in 1845 to 1895 when Utah wanted to become a state. And the problem was that polygamy was recognized in Utah. And so the controversy took about 50 years to resolve, 1845 to 1895, and Utah was finally admitted to statehood in the United States after it agreed to change its constitution and outlaw polygamy. That was the society as a whole saying, we're going to come together and we're going to say that a man married to two wives or three wives or four wives, that's not marriage. It doesn't do good for society the way one man and one woman being married does good for society. And so the whole country basically said, we're going to adopt this one definition of marriage. And nationally, our country has also said that other kinds of relationship aren't marriage because all 50 states have laws that prohibit incest from being recognized as marriage. A person can't marry a sister or a brother, for instance, or a son or a daughter. It's prohibited. And so the United States has faced this before, and there have already been court decisions about this. The Supreme Court, in a decision in 1885, Murphy v. Ramsey, said, "The idea of the family as consisting in and springing from the union for life of one man and one woman is the sure foundation of all that is stable and noble in our civilization." And so the nation said, we have a strong interest in protecting and encouraging marriage between one man and one woman because of great benefits that no other relationship or institution can give. If we don't have a standard of marriage that's established by the whole society through its government, then what do you have? We will have a proliferation of children born in relationships of incest, of polygamy, and of many temporary sexual relationships without commitment, and many, many children born without a very effective legal obligation to care for them. Aristotle, ancient Greek philosopher, said the first duty of wise legislators is to define and regulate marriage. Here's what Aristotle said. "Since the legislator should begin by considering how the frames of the children whom he is rearing may be as good as possible, his first care will be about marriage, at what age citizens should marry, and who are fit to marry." Oh, I didn't mention that. All the laws of the United States, you can't get married at age 10 or 12. I don't think you can get married before, I don't know, in some states maybe as young as 16, but certainly there are regulations that children can't marry each other as well. So if people today say that governments don't need to define marriage at all, That is just saying that we can hope to act contrary to the entire course of all societies in all of world history for all time. That argument does not encourage optimism for success. So here are the benefits that come from marriage. Point A, marriage provides a better environment for having babies than any other relationship or institution. We called our oldest son, Elliot, who was 36 yesterday, and we were just, or 2 days ago, and we were just talking with him, saying, when Margaret and I brought you home, when Mom and I brought you home from the hospital, we had no idea what to do. Now what do we do? And that's, at least we had each other to talk to and help care for this little treasure, who is now a 36-year-old pastor in North Carolina. But think about how a mom and a dad together can help in caring for a baby. Best institution, best environment for having babies. Better than just a single parent or a child left abandoned, for sure. B, married couples raise and nurture children far better than any other human relationship or institution. Children who live with their own two married parents have higher educational achievement, better economic standard, much less likely to end up in poverty, better physical health, better emotional health, less likely to commit crimes, less likely to engage in alcohol and substance abuse, more likely to live according to higher standards of integrity and moral purposes, less likely to experience physical abuse, more likely to live in homes that give support, protection, and stability, more likely to establish stable families for the next generation. Look at that list. Is that beneficial to society? To have those things happen to children? Those are massive benefits that come to the whole society because children are raised better in a family that has a mom and a dad together. Now you say, well, wait a minute, don't single parents raise children? Oh, they do, and sometimes heroically they do. But the fact that we recognize that they are heroic in their efforts and recognize that they oftentimes need much help and support itself proves that that's not the ideal place for raising a child. And we don't recognize that as the best thing. What is best, what society should encourage, is the best environment for raising children, and that is one man and one woman married, and so children have a mother and a father. Stanley Kurtz, a researcher at the Hudson Institute, wrote this. In setting up the institution of marriage, society offers special support and encouragement to the men and women who together make children. Because marriage is deeply implicated in the interests of children, it is a matter of public concern. That is what the government should be concerned about. Children are helpless. They depend upon adults. Children depend on society to create institutions that keep them from chaos. Children cannot articulate their needs. Children cannot vote. Yet, children are society. They are us, and they are our future. That's why society has the right to give special support and encouragement to an institution that's necessary to the well-being of children, even if that means special benefits for some and not others. The dependence intrinsic to human childhood is why unadulterated libertarianism can never work. It doesn't take care of the children who are the future of our society. Point C, or number three, so it's the best place to have babies and care for them, best place to nurture and raise children. C, or number three, marriage provides a guarantee of lifelong companionship and care far better than any other relationship or institution. That's a tremendous benefit for marriage. I remember my parents at age 90 and 91 caring for each other. And they did that for their whole lives. But marriage does that. It provides a benefit, and society is right to encourage that. Four, or D, marriage leads to a higher economic standard and diminished likelihood of ending up in poverty. That's good for society, on average. Number five, or E, marriage provides women with protection against domestic violence and abandonment far better than any other human relationship or institution. Cohabitation, or a man and woman living together, it doesn't provide nearly the protection against domestic violence. and it certainly doesn't provide protection against abandonment. But marriage, with its commitment, does that. Not perfectly, but better than any other institution. Number six, marriage encourages men to socially beneficial pursuits far better than any other human institution. What's that mean? You go to work, says Alan. Yeah, you go to work and get a job. Instead of, I don't know, instead of playing video games, I guess. Seven, men and women in general have an innate instinct that values sexual faithfulness in intimate relationships. And marriage encourages that faithfulness better than any relationship or institution. That is, even secular society, apart from the teachings of the Bible, recognizes that faithfulness, sexual faithfulness in marriage is a value. It's something to be protected and honored. Recent history in the United States within the last several weeks, the tragedy involving Tiger Woods and his marital unfaithfulness, and how the whole society recognizes that he really was, he betrayed his wife and did wrong. And now, what in the last couple of weeks, it's come out that Sandra Bullock, after winning the Academy Award for Best Actress in that great movie, Blindside, discovered that her husband has been unfaithful. And it isn't just Christians who are saying, oh, that's a tragedy. It's the whole society that's saying, something's wrong here. Or John Edwards, a former presidential candidate, and his unfaithfulness. Or what's Mark Sanford, the governor of South Carolina, and his marital unfaithfulness, just to give one Republican and one Democratic example. Marital unfaithfulness is not confined to either party, sadly. But the whole society recognizes, and Sanford now has, his wife has divorced him, and he's going to lose the governorship of South Carolina. He won't, and he's not going to run for president, obviously. And neither is John Edwards. That is, their lives are destroyed. Society in general values sexual faithfulness in intimate relationships, and marriage protects that better than anything. Does society have an interest in protecting that? Yes, it does. How about number eight? Marriage provides greater protection against sexually transmitted diseases than other relationships or institutions. Number nine, the biological design of men's and women's bodies argues that sexual intimacy is designed to be enjoyed between only one man and one woman. Point J, conclusion, for all of these reasons, marriage is the basic building block of any stable society, and it's essential to the continuation of a healthy, stable society. So here's what I'm arguing. I'm just saying, even apart from the Bible, you can say, what should our laws do? Our laws should do things that are good for society. And here, a marriage between one man and one woman does immense good for society in at least 10 different ways that I've just listed, having to do with children and mutual care and protection and support and marital faithfulness and encouraging beneficial activities in society and protection against disease. And it's just the foundational unit of society. So societies throughout history, and our society throughout its history, has said, we're going to set up our laws in such a way that we recognize this institution of one man and one woman that we're going to call marriage. And we're going to give it certain benefits, and we're going to give it certain legal benefits and financial benefits and certain obligations to care for each other and be financially responsible and other things for each other. And we're going to give it certain responsibilities to be responsible for the care and raising of children, for example. And so we want to encourage it because it's the future of our society and it's the building block of all that it's more basic than schools and businesses and governments and churches and everything. Marriage is more basic to society. Now, I want to add a point here after this section 2, after 2J at the top of the page, and that is to say homosexual relationships do not give society these benefits. Homosexual relationships do not give society these benefits, but rather result in harm and destructive consequences for society. And here I'm going to mention just some information from an excellent book on this topic by Jeffrey Satinover, S-A-T-I-N-O-V-E-R, Jeffrey Satinover. Satinover is a psychiatrist. He's a graduate of MIT and Harvard University and the University of Texas. He's lectured at Harvard. He's been a fellow teaching psychiatry at Yale, a widely recognized physician psychiatrist. And in this book, Homosexuality and the Politics of Truth, Satinover gives some very troubling information. What are the consequences? And just remember that previous list of the benefits of marriage between one man and one woman. Now contrast that with this. In homosexual relationships, number one, a significantly decreased likelihood of establishing or preserving a successful marriage. 25 to 30 year decrease in life expectancy. I'm going to say that again. And this is for male homosexuals. A 25 to 30 year decrease in life expectancy. Does society want to encourage conduct that predictably, statistically, on average, results in people dying 25 to 30 years younger and having the consequences to self and society that come from all the illnesses that lead up to a 25 to 30 year decrease in life expectancy? Chronic, potentially fatal liver disease, infectious hepatitis, inevitably fatal immune disease, including associated cancer, frequently fatal rectal cancer, multiple bowel and other infectious diseases, much higher than usual incidence of suicide. And, Satinover says, hopefully, at least a 50% likelihood of being eliminated through lengthy, often costly, and time-consuming treatment, and a very high success rate, in some cases nearing 100%, for groups of highly motivated and carefully selected individuals. In other words, it can be changed, or it can be cured. Does society have an interest in encouraging that kind of destructive behavior? I don't think so. Satinover says a 1981 study revealed that only 2% of homosexuals were monogamous or semi-monogamous, generously defined as 10 or fewer lifetime partners. What percentage of homosexuals have 10 or fewer lifetime partners? Less than 2%. In other words, 98% have more than 10 lifetime partners. 98%. 43% of male homosexuals estimated having sex with 500 or more different partners. 28%, that's over a quarter of male homosexuals, estimated having sex with 1,000 or more different partners, many of whom were strangers. What is the percentage of monogamous relationship then among homosexuals, of faithful monogamous relationship? That is not having sex with somebody else, significantly less than 2%. What is it for heterosexual couples? 83%. Does society have an interest in encouraging conduct that leads to those kinds of consequences? 30% of all 20-year-old homosexual males will be HIV positive or dead of AIDS by the time they're 30. I'll say that again. Of all 20-year-old homosexual males, 30% will be HIV positive or dead of AIDS by the time they are 30. Why? And Satinover says that the even if you factor out AIDS as a disease, there are multiple other diseases. Now, it's a little bit hard to listen to, but I think you don't hear this in the media at all. Do you? No, because there's a blackout on factual information about homosexual conduct and its disastrous harm that it brings. And then the question on legalizing homosexual marriage is, should we give societal improvement and approval and encouragement and endorsement to that kind of conduct? That's the question. Why? Now I'm going to read this. Satinover, a physician, says, "We are designed with a nearly impenetrable barrier between the bloodstream in our body and the extraordinarily toxic and infectious contents of the bowel. Anal intercourse, which is part of homosexual conduct, anal intercourse creates a breach in this barrier for the receptive partner, whether or not the insertive partner is wearing a condom. As a result, homosexual men are disproportionately vulnerable to a host of serious and sometimes fatal infections caused by the entry of feces into the bloodstream. These include hepatitis B and a cluster of otherwise rare conditions, bowel infections of various kinds. And so it leads to a systemic infection in the body, hepatitis, and other kinds of infection." And then Satinover, the psychiatrist, goes on and explains what happens with addictive behavior that becomes a feeling that it's compulsive and habitual. He talks about successful therapies that people are able to enter into and escape from a life pattern of homosexual conduct. And he's very hopeful about that regard. And I don't think he is writing as a Christian. He's just writing as a psychiatrist observing these things, but he especially mentions some Christian organizations and this one called Exodus International, particularly. It used to be called Desert Streams, I think, or Living Waters. And says they're unusually successful, but then he mentions other kinds of behavior. But he said, as far as the brain is concerned, repetition alters the pattern of the physical tissue in your brain. So I'm trying to learn to hit a golf ball better, and repetition of hitting it the right way changes the way your brain functions. Satinover says that people who learn to read Braille, the tissue in the brain section that controls your fingers grows and increases. That is, there's an actual physical change in your brain that comes from reading Braille, because habit builds brain tissue, not just connections. And he says compulsive behavior, addictive behavior, does that with regard to other kinds of addictions, alcoholism, drug addiction, addiction to pornography, addiction to gambling, addiction to homosexuality. And so he says, the studies that say, we've done autopsies on gay men and there's a larger brain section, some one area of their brain. Well, yeah, but that doesn't mean it's caused it. It means that it's the change, the actual brain wiring has changed as a result of repetitive behavior. Ben, you're the expert here. I'm giving very layman's. I'm okay? Okay. I just realized I have a neurologist sitting. He says I'm okay. All right. Yikes. But Satinover said, look, there may be some genetic, there's no genetic cause of this kind of behavior, absolutely. But he said that there may be some genetic factors that could be discovered that would predispose people to certain kinds of behavior. He said, in fact, as far as alcoholism, Scandinavians and people of Irish descent are particularly susceptible to alcoholism. Well, I was quite interested to read that, since on the one side I have Scandinavian ancestors and on my mother's side I have an Irish grandfather. So I'm predisposed, perhaps. Does that mean that I should say I have become an alcoholic? I can't prohibit it? No. It means that I should be exceptionally cautious and make choices with regard to my behavior that wouldn't lead me to becoming an alcoholic. And the same way, he says, with that may be with homosexual conduct, but it's not something that someone is born with. And of course, the proof against someone saying that this is one proof among many that this is genetically determined is that there are sets of identical twins where one person is homosexual and one is not. And of course, they have the same exact genetic makeup. So for all of those reasons, I think society has a strong interest in encouraging and protecting, preserving marriage between one man and one woman. And therefore, the laws should encourage and protect and define marriage. Now, what about legal arguments? Number three, the appeals courts in the United States have repeatedly held that the state, that is the government, has a legitimate interest in protecting marriage between one man and one woman. And I list some court cases there. No right to polygamous marriage is found in the United States Constitution. And that was declared by the United States Supreme Court Murphy v. Ramsey in 1885. In addition, no right to homosexual marriage is found in the Constitution. If you believe that the Constitution means what the original authors intended it to mean when it was written, then of course there's no question about that. There's no mention at all of homosexual conduct in the Constitution. And laws in all 50 states from the time of the Constitution up until very recent history have restricted marriage to a union of one man and one woman. No one has ever thought that there was a right to homosexual conduct in the Constitution. Point D. Now, here is the thing. Some people say, well, this is a fundamental right. In fact, there's a court case in California now on Proposition 8 saying, wait a minute, homosexuals have a fundamental right to be married just like anybody else does. And you know what we should answer to that? We should answer, yes, of course they do. But remember that marriage means one man and one woman. So a homosexual man, or someone who claims to be homosexual, who wants to get married, can be married just in the same way every other man in society can be married, that is, to a woman. There is no restriction on the right to marry that is put on homosexuals that's not put on everybody else. That is, you can only marry someone of the opposite sex. And so what I say in the outline here is marriage has always been defined in U.S. law as between one man and one woman, except for recent states that have changed that. Persons who claim to be homosexuals already have the same right to be married to someone of the opposite sex that everybody else does. That is, they can be married to someone of the opposite sex. But wait a minute, I want to marry someone of the same sex. Well, then you're asking to redefine marriage. See, that's what the issue is. It's asking to redefine marriage for the whole society. Whereas it's no longer a union of one man and one woman. That's what the argument is about. It's not just the right to get married, it's the right to marry someone of the same sex, which marriage has never meant. Therefore, my conclusion is we should not recognize same-sex relationships as marriage. Those relationships don't bring the benefits to society that marriage between one man and one woman brings. And those relationships are physically destructive. And then as Christians, we could add another reason they're morally wrong according to the biblical standards, which I mentioned last week. In Romans 1, 26 to 27, in 1 Corinthians 6, 9 to 11, 1 Timothy 1, 9 and 10, which I read and talked about last week. And surely Romans, I mentioned Romans 1, 26 to 27. It seems to me the greatest permanent solution to this would be a marriage amendment to the United States Constitution. It would prevent courts in individual states or future United States Supreme Court from redefining marriage. That was attempted while President George W. Bush was president. It was defeated in the House and in the Senate because a constitutional amendment requires substantial, it can only be done with substantial difficulty. And right now the political situation in the United States is not such that you could get enough votes to pass a constitutional amendment to the United States Constitution. But the political climate of a country changes quickly. And so what I'm saying is, as Christians, that's the kind of situation that we should favor ultimately if we can. I had a couple of other March 16th, which is just 12 days ago, Center for Disease Control in the United States, government agency, found that the rate of new HIV diagnoses among men, that leads to AIDS, new HIV diagnoses among men who have sex with men is more than 44 times that of other men, and more than 40 times that of women. If you put aside the question of AIDS, the rate of syphilis among men who have sex with men is more than 46 times that of other men, and more than 71 times that of women. Objection. You Christians, you're just trying to impose your moral standards on the rest of society. That's point C on your outline. Answer, no. Attempting to persuade people that marriage brings good to society and encouraging homosexual conduct does damage to society, that's not trying to impose my moral standards on anybody. That's simply trying to persuade the country that this is beneficial for society. And that's what we want to do when we enact laws. We want to enact laws that are beneficial to a society. It's not the same as imposing them on others. For us, point two, the Bible presents these standards for marriage as the true standards for the whole society and every nation. But we don't have to use those arguments in the public square if people don't accept the Bible. I'm going to add point three here under C. This is not violating the First Amendment. David Boies, B-O-I-E-S, one of the highly regarded constitutional lawyers in the United States, was one of the lawyers bringing a lawsuit against Proposition 8 in California. Proposition 8 was where the citizens of California voted to amend the Constitution to say marriage is between one man and one woman. David Boies and another attorney brought a lawsuit against this in a federal court in California, and the judge has heard the arguments, but he hasn't ruled yet, and there's some legal maneuvering going on. After the trial was over, the judge is himself homosexual. So if you hear that a federal district judge has ruled that Proposition 8 was unconstitutional in California, don't be surprised. Both sides expect it'll be appealed to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. And if that happens, because it's the most liberal court of appeals in the United States, it may lose there, but it'll be appealed to the Supreme Court then, and there'll be a decision. And that's good. But when people said, when people objected to Boies bringing this constitutional challenge, he said, our argument is that a majority is not entitled to impose its religious beliefs on a minority. See, their tactic is to say, if you say marriage is between one man and one woman, that's a religious belief. And the First Amendment says, Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. Is it a religious belief to say that marriage is between one man and one woman? Here, I had a little bit of conversation with a former Court of Appeals judge, a United States Court of Appeals judge, and he just said in one sentence, he said, well, the founders didn't seem to think so. And I think what he meant by that was respecting an establishment of religion meant what church you go to. Freedom of religion means you don't force everybody to go to the same church. But while the founders said you can't have laws respecting an establishment of religion, they had all sorts of laws regarding marriage and other kinds of moral things. Murder, stealing, other things. Religion was thought to be a distinct topic from laws concerning marriage and laws concerning the rest of society. Laws concerning marriage, when I say marriage is the best situation for raising children, guaranteeing lifelong marital faithfulness, encouraging men to beneficial pursuits, it's better for protecting health and financial stability and encouraging children to grow up and be productive members of society. That's not a religious argument. There's not a religious argument in that whole list. I'm just saying these are benefits that come to society from encouraging this relationship. Is that making sense? So if you say that Christians can't argue for this on the basis of the benefits, even apart from the Bible, well, then you're saying that Christians don't have a vote. Basically, your opinion doesn't count because you figured it out from the Bible. But you know what that would mean? That would mean that we and Roman Catholics don't have any say about abortion laws either, because we get that standard from the Bible. And we don't have any say about capital punishment. We don't have any say about just war. We don't have any say about anything, because everything we believe is derived from the Bible. So that is attempting to silence a Christian viewpoint. And the Alliance Defense Fund lawyers have rightly argued back, you're prohibiting the free exercise of religion if you do this. Jack, thank you. It's 10:20, so I have to make a quick decision now. What am I going to do for the next 5 minutes? Let's see. I'm going to talk for 5 minutes. I'm going to take 10 minutes of questions. Okay, so the First Amendment never prohibited laws based on moral and religious convictions, contrary to David Boies, contrary to the Iowa Supreme Court and others. Let's see, recommendations for laws. I guess this flows out of what I've said. Marriage should be defined by government for society as a whole. It's the only institution that can define it. Laws should continue to define marriage as union between one man and one woman. Laws should make other restrictions on marriages that reflect historical and traditional standards. Those are beneficial for society. No incest, no marrying underaged children, no marrying someone who's already married, things like that. And you see, this idea that, oh, homosexuals should have the right to marry another person of the same sex because that's what they want to do. Well, then what do you say to a guy who comes along and says, I want to marry my 12-year-old daughter because that's what I want to do? How do you prohibit that? You say, this is not beneficial but harmful to society. Or a brother and sister who want to get married. Or a man and woman who come and say, we want to get married, and the judge says, well, Mr. Smith, it looks like you are already married. Well, that doesn't matter. I want to marry somebody else, too. See, a person's desire doesn't determine what the law should be. There isn't a right to be married to whoever you want. There are restrictions. Homosexual relationships, then, number four, should not be granted the status of marriage. Number five, as far as domestic partner benefits, I do not think that those should be given to homosexual relationships or normalized as civil unions because it's encouraging a harmful relationship. That's the question of what the law should do. If the members of society wish to do this, of course, they're free to do so, but I don't think we should support it. Domestic partner benefits, if allowed, should not be limited to homosexual domestic partners, but should apply to all living people living together in a long-term relationship, such as a man living with his elderly father and caring for him, or two sisters living together and caring for each other, or perhaps even two friends in a non-sexual relationship. And I'll skip over number five. It's just saying those domestic partner benefits are just giving encouragement to a relationship that isn't helpful to society and that's harmful for children. Now, some people say, wait a minute, we think homosexual relationships are helpful for children. And here's a case that we found. And my response is, okay, let's vote on it. Let the society decide if it thinks that these are relationships that are helpful for children or not. And of course, the data are overwhelming to say they're not. Number six, known homosexuals should continue to be prohibited from military service. Secretary of Defense within the last week loosened those restrictions. The reason is that effective military service depends on a bonding, a non-sexual bonding between the men fighting together in a combat unit, relating as brothers, a band of brothers. And that intense loyalty to one another develops and leads to fighting cohesion in a military unit. If you have sexual intimacy injected into that group of men, you all of a sudden have a different kind of bonding that is exclusive and leads to favoritism and jealousy and perhaps a fear of being approached in an unwanted way for sexual intimacy, and it destroys military cohesiveness. And for that reason, we've had that policy of known homosexuals not being allowed to serve in the military, and I think that should continue. Number seven, I'll skip over. Number eight, I'll skip over. Number nine, and then we'll be done. Should homosexual conduct itself be against the law? No. I'm not going to go to the next page. The next page is pornography, and that'll be the following week. Should homosexual conduct itself be against the law? For years and years and years in the United States, probably a couple hundred years, over 200 years, this was the case. But as a matter of fact, laws concerning sexual relationships between consenting adults, such as fornication, for instance, were never enforced in the United States, even though they were on the books. And so I think certainly the political climate wouldn't allow homosexual conduct itself to be viewed as illegal in the United States now. But also, whereas in 1986, Bowers v. Hardwick, the United States Supreme Court upheld a Georgia law prohibiting homosexual conduct, in 2003 in Lawrence v. Texas, the Supreme Court overruled that law and said we can't have laws against homosexual conduct. So it's the law of the Supreme Court decree now. But I don't think that that should be our major concern, to try to regulate sexual conduct between consenting adults. The question should be, just like I don't think right now it would be useful to have laws against fornication. Too difficult to enforce, and there are too many other laws that we need to be concerned about. But I do not think that we should give the encouragement of society to such relationships and the approval and endorsement of that those relationships by an act of law in society. That's the end of what I was going to say. Jack has kept me on time. We have quite a bit of time now for a little bit of interaction. I would encourage you to order and buy this Satinover book if you want to read just one thing on homosexuality. It's just, it's by an excellent scholar and respected physician, just an excellent but sobering book. Okay. John. Oh, do we have a microphone up here?
So after saying all that, do you feel that the decisions that a society makes, like the United States of America, if they adopt homosexuality, do you think that that changes God's feeling toward the United States?
Yes. God judges nations in history for their conduct. And what nations approve through the ballot box is a very significant indication of the moral and spiritual climate of a nation. And God takes that seriously. Yeah. Rose.
I just wanted to comment on the financial benefits of marriage with regard to this new health care. The redistribution of your money depends on how much you earn. A single person is 200,000. A married couple is 250,000. But two people living together not married is 400,000. So that's not so beneficial. Now, I also wanted to comment. You said this gentleman, Satinover, indicated that 2%, was it 2%?
Less than 2% of I think it was male homosexuals, less than 2% are at least minimally monogamous, that is, have less than 10 partners during a lifetime.
Okay, then that was the wrong thing I'm referring to. He mentioned that they die younger.
25 to 30-year reduction in average life expectancy.
Okay, so right now that didn't apply to Barney Frank.
Apparently he's an exception. Thank you, Rose.
I have to tell you, the Tea Party doesn't come to Phoenix very often, but it's there today at 2 o'clock on the Capitol. If any of you are interested, bring your signs.
Okay. Yeah, Bob?
Your word encouragement, you know, we shouldn't do things to encourage this kind of behavior. And it brought to mind about 2 or 3 months ago, the city of Scottsdale mounted a campaign to attract homosexuals to come to Scottsdale, to the hotels and, you know, dinner and all of that. And, you know, the way it just creeps in, and that's for economic benefit. It just, if we didn't know about it, we need to let the city know that that is not acceptable.
Yeah, it's our society encouraging a behavior that's harmful to society in the long run. Short-term economic benefit from influx of tourists, but also short-term economic loss from discouraging other tourists from coming. Yeah.
Hi, Wayne. Mackie Martin.
Mackie.
I just wanted to say that recently my husband died about 3 months ago, and at his memorial, you know, my children said, well, we need a spokesperson for the family, and I told them, absolutely not. I said, each of your experiences are something unique to him. And so when I got up, I told him I came from a broken home. I was a first generation nearly. I was the only one always in the class and so on and so on. And I deliberately looked for a man that, number one, was a Christian, and I became a Christian. I think that's huge. But after the memorial, we've had tons of calls, notes, people coming to us. One boy left, a man left, one of my son's friends left and called his father that he was estranged from and said that he didn't want him to die and then be estranged.
Wow.
One was a plastic surgeon that's a client of mine and said he went home, told his wife he had to go to his bedroom. He couldn't be bothered for a while. He was very emotional.
Yep.
Said, I just don't get this God thing and whatever.
Yeah.
I just have to tell you that we are walking testimonies. In my office, I work in an office that's probably 50% homosexuals.
What is your occupation?
I'm a realtor.
Okay.
And one of the things, when I first showed up, I made a conscious choice because my thought was to leave.
Yep.
And I decided that my influence was better by staying than by leaving.
Yep.
And there's one in especially, but all of them know my stance on my faith.
Yep.
And one of them, we just have very open conversations, but I continue to tell him that I pray for him. And he even says to my kids, your mother's going to pray me into being straight.
Hmm.
So, you know, I think there's a way to tell people that it's not right and you're not offensive, but that you're praying for them. And hopefully they're praying for you that you get your stuff together.
Yeah. Mackie, thank you so much for saying that. I think what I didn't touch on is how we as Christians should relate to people who are professing homosexuals. And certainly with love and kindness and care and support and perhaps friendship, we can be friends with sinners, can't we, in all different areas of life, but not with approval of the conduct. And a testimony of one after another of thousands of homosexuals is I secretly wanted to get out of this lifestyle, and I didn't know how to do it. So I think we need to recognize that, too, because there's a law of God written on everybody's heart, conscience. Now, look, I want to watch the time. I want to get over to Kathy Herod. So we have only one microphone?
Yes.
Just take a minute, and then I'll go over to Kathy. We're still okay on time.
Because of the well-documented promiscuity of homosexuals, it seems to me that this whole political activism for homosexual marriage is really more about the destruction of conventional marriage than it is about homosexual marriage.
Yeah. Alan Sears has argued that in a book called The Homosexual Agenda, head of Alliance Defense Fund. And others have said that too. The goal of many in that homosexual movement is to destroy the traditional family, and that's the building block of society. So, I mean, it's really an attack at the fundamental institution that holds society together. So, it is an extremely serious attack at the foundations of society and threatens the future of our society or any society. Okay, good. Thanks. I want to say Kathy Herod is the president of Center for Arizona Policy and spearheaded the campaign to get a constitutional amendment passed by the voters of Arizona in 2008, November 2008, and that was successful. So
Thank you. Go ahead. Two quick points. On domestic partner benefits, something to always remember is when the California Supreme Court redefined marriage in that state on May 15, 2008, they cited the California laws on domestic partner benefits, on non-discrimination. All these laws that had given homosexuals a certain place in the law were cited by the court as saying you can't then deny marriage.
I see.
So why we fight every step of the way on something that gives homosexuality a privileged or special place in the law is because there's a domino effect. There's a cumulative effect where then the courts say, okay, you can't say all these benefits are granted to homosexuals and then say they can't be married.
Yep.
So that was a key thing in the California Supreme Court. The other thing that I really want to emphasize is the prevailing view in our state today is that children no longer deserve a chance to have a mom and a dad. So all these attacks on marriage has really led to the social work mentality, meaning that whether it's an adoption, whatever it is, that children no longer deserve a mom and a dad. That's what, when we sanction same-sex marriage, we say from the get-go, it no longer matters what type of family structure a child has. This is not about single parenting. Our biggest fight in the Arizona legislature right now is to establish an adoption law, a preference for married couples over single adults. The proposed bill has a number of exceptions in it for single adults, but what we're trying to say is that all things being equal, if the adoption agency or the state is deciding to place a child with a single adult or a married couple, the child should go to the married couple because of the social science data. And you would think it's just amazing the attack that's on it, but here's what has to happen. Single adults are the ones that are adopting children in foster care, and that a lot of them are homosexuals. This isn't about gay adoption, but that's what's happening. So it's up to all of us to step up to the plate and make sure these kids have homes. But we need to give these kids homes, and, you know, Mark Upton's certainly working on this. But I just wanted to share, you know, my heartbeat that it doesn't matter that kids have a mom and a dad is what we're fighting every day in the Arizona legislature right now. Adoption's not about the desires of adults. It's about what's doing what's right for children. And we've got to restore some of the privileged place that marriage has had but doesn't have anymore.
Thank you, Kathy, very much. Thank you, thank you. Our Lord Jesus, we thank you that we can come to you with this and with all the other concerns and needs of our hearts and lives. We do come to you now as the one into whose hands has been given all authority in heaven and on earth. As the one who raises up kings and puts down kings. As the one who directs the hearts of people in nations. Lord, will you change the hearts of the people in our nation? Will you let truth be known and not covered up and hidden? Lord, will you let truth about marriage and about homosexual relationships be known and lead our people as a nation, lead our judicial system, lead our legislators, lead our elected leaders to make right decisions about this, Lord, decisions that would help and not harm our society. We pray for this nation that you would have mercy upon us and yet turn our hearts to your ways and to you. Amen. See you in 2 weeks.